Welcome to Reconceive, a Beyond Studio podcast, where two mental health therapists and a fitness coach explore the interweaving connections of mind, body, and spirit. Every episode covers an area of this connection and how we can reimagine ourselves and our world when we see these connections more clearly.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Reconceive, a Beyond Studio podcast. This is episode 6. Today we are exploring what it is we really want in our lives and how we move towards getting what we want or sometimes stand in our own way. We're going to talk about what it is to long for things to be different and then identify the barriers that get in our way. We will then identify how we can move past those barriers and embrace new ways of thinking about ourselves. We want to go a step beyond the usual thoughts about positive thinking and delve more deeply into why positive belief systems can be so powerful in our lives. So let's get started.
Okay. So last time we got together, we were talking about negative beliefs and how negative beliefs come from trauma. And we gave tons of examples of negative beliefs from our own experience that we had and also from our clients. Negative beliefs like, it's my fault, I'm unattractive, I'm not worth it, I'm not enough, all of those. So today's conversation kind of pushes that a step further, and we want to look at ways of thinking positively about ourselves and ways of getting what we want. We all want, but it's not always okay for us to want. We don't always feel like it's okay for us to want. And actually, you know, I was thinking about that part of it, and I try to start every therapy relationship with that question, what do you want? And it's not just a simple question. People have trouble answering that oftentimes. And that's a cue for me to know kind of what we need to work on first, because knowing what we want is really important to being able to get it and to be able to move forward and change. So we need to talk about wanting, and then we need to talk about belief systems that help us get what we want.
Or the ones that sometimes stand in our way from moving forward and actually believing that that's possible.
Right, right.
I think that question, because that's a question that I ask clients a lot as well, that is a surprisingly vulnerable question. Because for most of us, we are not super honest with, well, sometimes even ourselves, but certainly with other people about what it is that we actually want in life, kind of the aspirations, the dreams, the bigger things than just the basics. I think a lot of us feel embarrassed about mm-hmm. how much we really want or what it is that we really want. And saying those things out loud somehow make it a little too concrete for comfort sometimes. And I like to ask that question, you know, even of myself sometimes in different situations of what am I really wanting here? Why am I doing this? What do I hope to achieve in this situation? Because I do think it's incredibly revealing when we're actually honest with that answer, partly because we're rarely honest with that answer.
Yeah, people tend to answer that question in one of three or four different ways. And very rarely will somebody say, I want to live on my own on an island and run a snow cone stand. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get, you know, very hesitant responses. I rarely get something that concrete. Typically, I don't know is the first thing people say. I don't really know what I want. I just know that I feel bad and I'm here and I guess I want to feel better. And so there we have a start. You know, we've moved from I don't know to I want to feel better, which is great. But then it seems like people tend to say, well, I would like this, but. Right. And so then fill in the blank. There's always a but.
The other answer I hear a lot of is I want to be a good blank. I want to be a good parent. I want to be a good employee, spouse, daughter, whatever. We tend to first try to answer that question in relation to what other people want rather than identifying first what we want and then looking at how that impacts other people. I think a lot of us feel compelled to consider the other person first. and make sure that we are, you know, being the kind of person that other people in our lives want us to be. And so that's the answer I get the most. I want to be a good blank, and whatever that blank happens to be, mm-hmm. For the person. And I catch myself doing this as well. I want to be a good therapist, which is a great aspiration. I want to be a good wife, a good mom. Those are good things. However, they're not nearly as vulnerable as saying, I want to be the best at what I do.
Yes.
Or I want to be, you know, I want to have the kind of marriage that people are jealous of. That feels way more vulnerable.
Pretty vulnerable.
Yes. Yeah. To actually declare those things out loud and admit that that's what we want. I think that we feel selfish.
And why? I'm just really confused about that. I have it myself, but why is that so vulnerable? And why does that make us feel selfish? And why is selfish such a bad thing? Maybe it's not.
Or maybe that's not actually selfish as we tend to define that word.
What is selfish?
I think we use that word to mean putting myself above other people when I shouldn't.
Hmm. Okay. Like not sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Being mm-hmm. stingy. I'm
right.
going back to kindergarten.
Right.
Not washing my hands before I touch
right.
the food.
Right. Not being polite. Not using manners. You know, taking more than your share of something. Not, you know, making sure that everybody else is comfortable before you get comfortable.
Hmm.
To me, I think that's what we tend to think of. And maybe that's a more female definition of it. I don't know. Maybe if we asked men that question, they would have a different answer.
Seems like selfish depends on who needs what.
Who needs what.
In any given
right.
time. Because if I have a two-year-old, their needs are going to be different from an 18-year-old. And so what I can do with my time really is going to be different mm-hmm. from what I can do later on when they're older, mm-hmm. when my two-year-old has grown up a bit.
Right.
So selfishness for the mom of a preschooler
looks very different. Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think that selfishness as a parent looks very different than selfishness as a friend or a spouse, because that is a different role. And maybe that's why we struggle with that so much, is that it is a bit of a moving target. It is not, you know, cut and dry about, am I being selfish right now, or is this good self-care? Am I being selfish right now, or am I setting a good boundary? And being confident in those decisions, I think, is something that a lot of us really struggle with.
Maybe it's like good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. Mm-hmm. There's a good selfishness.
Right.
And a bad selfishness. There's a selfishness that causes us to grow and ultimately causes everyone else around us to grow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then there's a selfishness that doesn't help anyone.
Right.
Including us.
Right. And I wish that we had another word for that. And maybe
I
we do,
too.
But at least in common communication, we don't use it. I think we have words like, you know, boundaries and being assertive and self-care that we're starting to use more and more. But in normal everyday conversation, we kind of throw selfish around as a catch-all for all of those things. And it's not the same. It doesn't feel the same. It doesn't produce the same results. A parent that is really good at self-care gets very different results in their relationship with their child versus the parent that is selfish. And so
yeah.
I do think that, you know, kind of challenging ourselves to use the correct word, but that also means that we have to understand the difference, which I think can be really tricky.
Well, okay. I just thought of a concrete example mm-hmm. that maybe will bring what you just said home a little bit. When you see a parent in the car smoking and you see children in the back seat, that's a scenario where I could apply the word selfish
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because clearly my addiction has taken precedence over my care
child's
for my
well-being.
Children. Yeah.
Right. Right. And I think that sometimes making it really black and white can help us feel the difference. And if we can kind of get an internal sense of how selfishness feels versus how self-care and assertiveness feels, mm-hmm. that maybe that's a better measurement for us to be using than what would other people think.
Well, right. Like the same parenting scenario, maybe we're talking about you do some yoga in the morning and during that time you're not as attentive.
Mm-hmm.
You know your child is safe, but you're busy doing yoga.
Right. Maybe you let your kid watch something, you know, on a screen for 30 minutes while you do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't seem too selfish. That seems like just health.
Right. Right. And I do think that, you know, that's a really big conversation. And I think it kind of takes us to the broader question that we're asking today of when we... The way that we think really defines what we do. And if we have a belief system around it's always wrong to be selfish, and anytime that I'm putting myself first, then that's being selfish, we're absolutely going to see behaviors that fall in line with that.
Yeah, you were talking earlier about barriers, and I was trying to think of other ways of thinking about barriers to getting what we want. Hurdles. Walls, and people use this kind of language when they talk about how they can't get what they want.
Right.
So these are things, these beliefs are blocking us from being able to act in our own best interest. And so we want to kind of look at what are the big ones, what are the biggies that block us,
right?
And how do we change them? How do we move toward, no, I deserve, it's okay, I deserve this.
The other one that I hear a lot from people is a sense of confusion. It's sort of this vague sense of, I know what it is I want, and I know that I'm not happy with where I am, but the how to get there and why can't I seem to make this change, there's just sort of this sense of hazy confusion around ourselves and why we do what we do and our motivation level. I hear this a lot with lifestyle changes. Things like, you know I want to be healthier. I want to feel different. I want my body to feel better, to be able to do things that I haven't been able to do. I want to be able to play with my kids or go for a hike and you know, not hurt the next day. I want all those things. So then why don't I do the things that get me there? There's sort of that feeling of confusion, and we're a little baffled at our own behavior. You know, why don't I do that?
Yeah, why don't I do it? I know the things to do. I know what to eat.
Right.
I know how to exercise. I have all the information. Why don't I do what I want? And so what you're saying is there may be a blocking belief that is stopping my movement toward that thing that I really want.
Right. And I think that confusion is when we have two belief systems that are in conflict with each other. And it's like we're waiting for one to win, and we don't know who's going to win yet. Well, so as a concrete example of that, one of the negative belief systems that I think is a barrier for a lot of people is that deep down, if we're really gut level honest, we don't believe that it could be better. We don't believe that we could feel better than this, deserve more than this, have a different partner, have a different kind of relationship. And if at a really gut level, we still believe that we're not worthy of those things, that they're impossible to achieve, and I can't even imagine me, you know, having that.
Yeah.
Then that absolutely causes that confusion. I can say all day long, here's what I want. But if in my gut I don't believe it, we stay stuck. We stay confused.
Yeah. And we could talk about that in terms of vibration. Or we could talk about that in terms of actual concrete behavior. It comes out in a lot of different ways. So while you were saying that, I was thinking about money and how in my family of origin, there was this idea, and I think this really came from my dad's side. They were sort of these Irish, Scotch-Irish, Protestant, very sad people. They were really sad. Well, and they had had some really hard times and had, you know, been very poor. So there was this idea in his family that I'm sure goes way back that we will never have that much money. And always a wanting, but never overt wanting, always sort of just jealous of people who did have more, which fed further the idea that we will never have more. We can't. We don't deserve it. We just can't have it.
It is somehow unattainable for us.
It's unattainable for us. Other people might be able to attain it, but not us. And that got passed down to me in some strange ways, so that I'm surprised every time my income, you know, rises to a certain level, I'm always surprised and really pleased, but I am taken by surprise. I don't know quite what to think of that.
Well, and I think I hear this from a lot of people at certain kind of benchmarks in our life. One of the big points that I think people struggle with this is any time that we go beyond what our family has done before, any time that, you know, we achieve a certain level of education mm-hmm. or financial comfort or home or car, you know, whatever it may be materialistically, anytime we go beyond kind of the previous precedent in the family, yeah. I think we feel this a little bit. Yes, there's, you know, the enjoyment of getting that and there's some pride involved in it, the good kind of pride, but there's also that feeling of, wait, is this okay?
Is this okay?
Is this really, you know, I don't want to brag about it. I don't want to make too big a deal about it. Because
naughty, I don't want to push people away.
Right. I don't want to, you know, sound like I think I deserve it and they didn't deserve it or whatever it might be. And so I think that that's one of the benchmarks where we tend to struggle with that is any time that we surpass.
So tonight I'm having dinner with a former professor of mine from Texas Woman's University where I studied and I loved it there. And so Dr. Robert Littlefield is coming over. I haven't seen him in about 20 years, but I remember distinctly him telling our class that when his doctoral students would get to the end of the program, and of course, you know the statistics on ABD, so many people are all but dissertation. They're mm-hmm. almost done with their doctoral degree, but they don't finish it because of whatever. He believed that it was a family of origin issue. Mm. And so he would ask them if they were stuck at dissertation, he would say, why don't you call your mother tonight and ask her if it's okay if you're a doctor? And he would always be able to pick the right parent, first of all, which I thought was just really uncanny. Mm. And then his students would either do that and get unhooked from whatever family, you know, myths were sort of mm-hmm. like that invisible gas in the family. We mm-hmm. can all smell it. We don't know what it is. Or they would just say, I'm not going to do that. That's stupid. I can be a doctor. I don't have to ask my mother. And then they'd be unhooked, which kind of gets to that, you know, family and where these belief systems come from. Maybe they're never spoken out loud, mm-hmm. but
in every way implied.
Implied.
Yeah. Well, and I think they're usually implied by how do we hear people talking about other people that have achieved that level of success or whatever. It's never directed specifically at us, but as kids in particular, we're so sensitive to how do people talk about other people. And we're constantly gleaning information about that. And the word, Deborah, when you were saying that, the word that comes to mind for me is permission. So much of the time we don't realize that we're actually waiting for somebody to give us permission to take the next step or be that happy or, you know, challenge ourselves in that way or challenge the status quo in a situation. And, you know, your example of sometimes we need it to be from someone else and we need to figure out who is that I'm waiting for them to give me permission. Sometimes the answer is me. I have to give myself permission. I have to say it is okay. You know, at this point, I think Brené Brown is almost a household name. Oh, yeah. If you're not familiar with Brené Brown, please be. Go discover her because she's wonderful. But one of the things that she talks about in several of her books and articles is the idea of writing ourselves permission slips, of making it this very concrete thing where we, if we're going into a challenging situation that we know is going to be difficult for us, potentially shaming for us in any way, that we actually write down, what do I need to give myself permission for? Do I need to have permission to look a little foolish? Do I need to give myself permission to be smart, to be the one that knows, to be the one in charge? Do I need to give myself permission to be that vulnerable, to say what I really want in a situation? And I think there's so much power in being concrete with ourselves about what am I needing permission for in this situation?
Which really brings up this thought about failure for me. I think that a lot of times when we're making change, we're making a big transition, or we want to make a big transition, we're feeling like somehow we've failed if we, for instance, go back to school and change careers at midlife, which a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. We can feel like, no, that's not prudent. I'd be failing. I'd be letting everyone down. And so maybe I need permission to fail. Maybe I need permission turn the ship around.
Risk something not working.
Risk, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is probably the biggest kind of permission that has personally been important. The permission to fail or try when failure is an option. I think the farther we get in life, the more we start taking away our right to risk and fail, and we get more and more stuck, and therefore more and more frustrated, which means that if we want things to change, a really good place to look is, where do I need permission to risk and fail? And if we can do that, if we can really give ourselves that permission, it unhooks us from all of those negative beliefs. And now suddenly the positive belief that's in its place is, I can fail and still be okay. Mm-hmm. I can look foolish. I can not have all the answers and still be okay.
So what if you realize that where you're hooked on your old belief, or where you're hooked on not having permission, is a person, and that person is never going to say, yes, you can be a doctor. Yes, you can take a lover. Yes, you can learn to dance. That person's never going to give it to you. Then what do you do?
Mm-hmm. Good question. What do you do? And I honestly think that we have to evaluate, why are we still allowing that person to have that kind of power in our lives? Mm-hmm. Sometimes the answer is really practical. They're financially supporting us. Mm. They're our co-parent, and they, you know, have a lot of influence in our life. We're attached to them forever in that way. Sometimes it really is practical. And then we have to ask ourselves hard questions like, is this thing that I'm wanting more or less important than the way this person is benefiting me in a practical way? And I think that has to be a really personal decision. You know, I can never tell someone, yes, it is worth it or not worth it. But I think it does keep us from getting unstuck if we're not even willing to ask that question. Even if we come to the point where we realize, no, the practical things are more important to me, and I want them more than I want this other thing, at least we're not in confusion anymore. Uh-huh. At least we get to live with all of that cleared out, and we get to be really honest with ourselves about why we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah, clarity feels good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Caroline Knapp wrote a book several years ago called Appetites, Why Women Want. And, you know, instead of what women want, which is what you expect, why women want. And it was all about eating disorders, which she ultimately died from at a young age. But her premise was that wanting is so fraught in our culture that wanting food becomes a place of real vulnerability and a place that we fight. We fight against our wanting. And a person with an eating disorder is fighting his or her wanting, craving, where if it were safe and permissible for that person to really clearly want and really crave and notice the craving, whether that's a craving for learning or love or the outdoors or food or whatever, then suddenly the relationship with food begins to change, and it's not so stressful. It's not an antagonistic kind of relationship anymore. And I think maybe that applies to other things too, when it's okay to really want and to keep wanting more. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I have a house. I have a roof over my head. I have a decent job. I can pay the bills, but now I want more. Now I want a job that I actually enjoy. Now I want to be surrounded by people that I like. Mm-hmm. That maybe it's a good thing that we continually want more.
And I sometimes wonder if we resist that because we're afraid of living in the in-between of wanting and not having. And I think my best experience with this has been dealing with infertility, which is a topic that for a long time it's been so taboo. It's been one of those things that you don't talk about. We kind of give easy answers to it, like, oh, you know, your body knows best, which is really unhelpful. You know, you just hear. No, I don't think you did. But people do. They say strange things, you know, in response to hearing that somebody wants a child and isn't able to have one. But that is such a black and white experience of wanting and not having. And my experience of it and what I have taken away from it being on the other end of it now is there is a full grief process that we go through in the process of not having what we want. And when we really have to come to terms with that, I think it feels like a kind of death to us. We mourn it as if we are mourning the death of someone we love, which explains to me, why do we avoid it so much? Why is it such a painful thing that, you know, we don't even want to say it out loud.
Right.
And we hear people say this, you know, well, I don't even want to imagine that when we're talking about losing a loved one, right? Because we're so convinced that if I say it out loud, it's somehow going to make it more concrete and more real and therefore more painful. And in retrospect, I was completely wrong about that. There was a kind of shift that happened when I started being really open and honest, first of all with myself and then with other people, about living in the in-between of I desperately want a baby and I don't know if I'm ever going to get one. And the kind of vulnerability and rawness that it takes to say that consistently, I honestly feel like it feels better than the hidden grief.
That makes so much sense to me because hidden grief is disenfranchised grief.
It's very isolating.
It's very isolating, yeah. And you can feel like, am I crazy? Why am I depressed? Nobody is going to give you the support you need if your grief is hidden like that. And that reminds me of advice that I used to hear from Dr. Littlefield, actually, and other marriage and family therapist trainers that I was exposed to in the 90s. There was this idea that when a couple was having difficulty, and if one of them was having the urge to leave, just leave and avoid the difficulty, depending on the couple, depending on where they were in their life cycle and what kind of closeness they had, what kind of bond they had, therapists were encouraging people to stay. Stay even though it's miserable. Stay even though your partner wants you to leave. Go ahead and stay and tolerate the discomfort and let yourself know that you are longing for something that you don't have. Let yourself feel that all the way through because that's more honest than running away. So it forms a kind of crucible in a way. So you're in this crucible and you're being tested. You're being sort of refined. And you get really clear about what you want that way.
Well, and I think that that's the important kind of conclusion to that advice is it's not for the purpose of being the good person that stays no matter what.
Right. No.
It's for the purpose of clarity and clearing out and really bringing to a head all the reasons why we're feeling what we're feeling. And what you see a lot of time in that situations is you get to a point where you discover what I am longing for has nothing to do with my partner and has everything to do with this thing over here. And I have been putting it over on this category. And sometimes we do it the other way around. We will start to get uncomfortable at work and start, you know, wanting to make a job change, wanting to do this, wanting to do that. And if we do the work, we then discover, oh my gosh, the longing is because I am so disconnected in my relationship and I don't have anything that I want at home. And I'm giving myself permission to shake it up over here in my career, but not giving myself permission to really look and see my marriage is nothing.
Right.
There's nothing there.
Right.
And I hate that. And I want it to be better. I want it to be different. So I do think there's a lot of wisdom in kind of slowing down and really asking ourselves that question of, you know, is the place that I'm feeling the discomfort really the place that I'm longing for change? And when we can get clear about where that longing really is, I think it frees up our energy to make sure that we're focusing our efforts on the place that's going to actually take us where we want to go. But that does require permission. It does require that vulnerability, that sense of risk, that willingness to fail, that willingness to look foolish, And I think that a lot of the time we will take the easy way out on stuff like that rather than tackling the thing that's really the burr in our saddle.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about men, and sometimes when I'm working with men, it seems like they have been told or conditioned to think that they have a role to play and a job to do, but they're really not allowed to want more. They're really not allowed to want more in relationship, especially. Mm-hmm. And they're not allowed to want to do something non-traditional or to really mix it up and change their work life, maybe become a stay-at-home dad and let their partner, you know, go earn the living. There's a lot of that feeling of being trapped or used or like I am disposable. I am just the meal ticket. I'm the person who has to earn the living. I'm the person who has to sort of keep things going. But I am not allowed to want things. I'm not allowed to have a heart that yearns. And I think there's a specific gender piece to that sometimes. Do you see that
in your work? I think that what we are culturally given permission to want is very different between the genders.
Yeah.
And there is kind of a list of things that we're allowed to want, even expected to want as women. We're expected and, you know, allowed to go after them, to use our energy to go after it, and men have the same thing. And I think in some ways, men have been very, very boxed in and given an incredibly short list.
Yeah.
And I think women, we kind of have our own version of that list. I think that the expectations are overwhelming at this point for women, but for men, they're incredibly restrictive.
They really are.
The definitions of what is culturally acceptable for them to pursue and go after and be passionate about. Mm-hmm. Even more so, I think that there's that myth of unless you're going to be really, really successful at it, mm-hmm. then you shouldn't want it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're going to be an amazing musician, that you're somehow going to make money with your music or with your artistic endeavor, mm-hmm. then, well, that's just a thing you should do in your garage and never show anybody.
Right.
There's kind of this this dividing line, and the question is, can you make money at it?
Uh-huh.
And if the answer is no, then it's not worth your passion. It's not worth your energy. And I think women have that to a small degree. I think men have that even more.
And the generation seems mm-hmm. to play a role. Younger
Agreed.
Men, I notice, are beginning to entertain the idea of, maybe I can have it all. Maybe I can put my passions together into something that I love to do. And maybe I don't have to be poor. I mean, or maybe I can spend significant time at home with my children and also earn a living or do something creative that sustains me, and then the money will come. I mean, there are all these new ways of thinking that I hear young men talking about, young men in their 20s and 30s, but I think guys in my generation were not thinking and are not thinking.
Right.
But it just wasn't, it wasn't okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been dealing with moving out of restrictive beliefs into more permissive beliefs, more open, deserving beliefs about what we want. And we've kind of talked about selfishness, and we've kind of talked about what's okay and what's not okay. What are some other barriers that we need to talk about before we sort of address how to move those out of the way?
I think that we touched on it, but it bears saying again that the people that we have around us are hugely influential in our ability to say yes to the things that we really want. Who we have influencing us, speaking into our lives, setting an example, encouraging, not encouraging, etc. There is a lot of evidence to say we don't go very far beyond the people that are close to us. We tend to match pace with those that we spend the most time with. And we have to, you know, really consider that when we are answering that question of what do I really want. The next question then is, have I built a life that will promote that?
You know, if Shauna were here
mm-hmm.
right now,
she
would talk about that, because that's kind of, you know, when we're talking about health and weight mm-hmm. and exercise and how, we do allow ourselves to be mm-hmm. limited in health practices mm-hmm. by the company that we keep.
Right. And I think that it holds true as well in relationships. Think about how influential it is if you're having relationship struggles or parenting challenges. I read a research study on postpartum depression and new moms and all of that and what's really influential. And one of the big things is how the women in your life talk to you about being a mom is actually an influential factor in whether or not you develop postpartum depression. The reason for this makes so much sense. It's the way that we interpret what's happening to us. And if we've never done this before, if, you know, being a mom or say being in a marriage or being in a serious relationship, if this is the first time we've ever done it and we don't know anything and all the people around us are telling us a certain thing, it is incredibly natural for us to begin to interpret our own experience through their experience. And so we have to be really mindful of who gets to be that voice for us. And immediately in the back of my head, I'm thinking, well, but it feels so bad to say I can't be friends with that person or I have to distance myself from that person in order to get what I want. But what if that's true?
What if it's true?
Yeah. And you know, is it worth the price that we would have to pay in order to keep that other person happy or in order to, you know, look like I'm being a good friend no matter what, I'm being really loyal in my friendships, even if that person is holding us back?
Yeah.
And maybe we don't have to be as black and white about it. Maybe we can redefine some of our friendships to say, these are ones that get to speak about this issue into my life and I will receive it. And these are ones where I recognize that I really care about them. I enjoy spending time with them, but they're not going to get to have a voice in this particular part of my life. I can't afford that.
One way to deal with that, I think, is the affirmation process that we use with tapping. Mm-hmm. And you guys may be familiar with tapping as a self-help technique. But if you haven't heard of it, I recommend the tappingsolution.com. That's a pretty good site to learn about basic tapping. And the emotional freedom technique, I think, is the original name for the tapping technique. And since you can't see us, you don't know that, like right now, I'm tapping the outsides of my eyes or right in my temples, just lightly back and forth, back and forth. And I might use that spot or the top of my head and lightly tap and say to myself, even though my parent doesn't want me to move to California, I know that I can trust my own instincts. Mm-hmm. Even though my spouse has lots of negative things to say when I tell him that I want to go back to school, I still love and accept myself. I can treat myself with respect. Mm-hmm. So we're saying two things. We're acknowledging what is. We're acknowledging
our reality.
The reality, what people are saying to us and this hurdle. And then we're also giving a nod to, it's okay for me to feel the way I feel. I can want this. It's all right to want this. Mm-hmm. So it's a two-part statement.
Yeah. And I think that really moves us to kind of the next step of the conversation, Deborah, which is how do we actually make change? What do we do on a really practical level? You know, we've talked a lot about kind of the thinking barriers and what gets in our way and what we can do about that to some degree. But on a really practical level, I think it comes down to getting very specific and concrete with ourselves about what we want and saying it out loud and saying it routinely. Hmm. Almost making it a mantra that we routinely come back to. And by routinely, I mean as often as we need to. Sometimes it's going to be multiple times a day.
So like, I deserve love.
I deserve love.
I deserve well-being.
Yeah. Yeah. Or I can have these things.
I can have them.
I remember, you know, when I very first started my own business and was just filled with fear about it all day long, every day, I would come to my calendar and cross my fingers and say, dear God, I hope that I'm going to make some money today. I found a sticker that said, let your faith be bigger than your fear. And I put it right on the front of my calendar. And every day before I opened it up, I would stand there and I would look at it and say, I am going to be scared out of my mind today, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to do it anyway. And I'm pretty sure that that's what got me through the first 6 months. And I would have absolutely lost my nerve otherwise, because we can't wait for fear to be gone before we decide to do something. And so saying that to ourselves, I don't have to wait for the fear to be gone. I can do this anyway. Those kinds of statements are so powerful, and they are centering to us. It kind of calms all of that confusion, all of that internal chaos that we struggle with, and says, today, this is what I'm going to focus on. This is how I'm going to talk myself through the struggle that I'm about to walk into. We don't have to convince ourselves that we're not afraid, that it's not painful, that it's not a struggle, that we're not grieving. We don't have to convince ourselves of any of that. We just have to have something to focus on and stand on that feels really solid. And those, even those statements that you just gave examples of, those are solid because it acknowledges reality and then it acknowledges what we want. And both of those things are very black and white, and our brain really relaxes on just a cognitive behavioral level. When we have something really firm to hold on to like that, it really begins to shift the way our brain responds to the challenges that we're facing.
Yeah. And one other technique, and I know we're running out of time, but we're coming back in a few episodes to talk about hypnosis. And we're going to kind of show how you can use hypnosis at home to help yourself with these things. But for now, let me just say that if you have an image of even someone else getting what you want, like an image of a healthy couple, and you can tell that they're really into each other and they really talk to each other, and you can see that clearly in your mind, focus on that picture. If you have an image of someone graduating, walking across the stage and getting their diploma, and you can see that, maybe you can even put yourself in that picture. Focus on that. Meditate on that picture. Meditate on the feeling of having enough money, that wonderful feeling of going to your bank account and seeing, oh my goodness, there's an extra $1,000 in there. I didn't know I had that. That feels so great. I could buy lots of shoes. Just notice how that feels and meditate on the feeling of it. And that's like a little bit of self-hypnosis.
Yeah. Adding to that, one of the other visuals that I really like is imagine how you would look when you have whatever that thing is. Mm-hmm. And by look, I mean, how would you stand? What would your body language be? What would you, you know, what would your facial expression be? Mm-hmm. How would you talk? What would your voice sound like if this was true in your life right now? And part of the reason why I really like that question, and I think it's really powerful, it because it involves our body in experiencing a taste of that reality. And it helps us not only feel motivated to look for it and to push towards that, but it also helps us recognize it when it's getting close. And it's kind of like getting it's the appetizer version of, you know, the meal that is to come. And I think that it really does shift our belief and shift our thinking. It is so powerful to be looking at the positive version of something rather than imagining life without the bad.
Yeah.
Me imagining life without struggling with infertility is 900 times different than imagining me as a mom. That mental picture is entirely different. And so we have to, you know, kind of work with the way that our brain naturally wants to function. And it likes to focus on the positive, the tangible, the concrete.
Yes.
And so mental imagery is really useful for that.
And imagination is 1,000 times more powerful than logic.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And one of the truths that I think helps with this is that we have to remember that according to the brain, really detailed imaginary experiences are very, very similar to reality. Our brain actually does not distinguish the difference.
Yeah.
And so we can use that to our advantage. So those are just kind of some concrete ideas of things that you guys can begin to do. This is by no means the last time we're going to talk about this, because there are so many tangible and really practical ways of helping yourself move towards this kind of positive change that goes way beyond just identifying the positive thought, but really how to embody it and experience it in the waiting, when we're in the in-between and waiting for that reality. How do we live there and be okay? So that's it for the show today. Thank you so much for joining us. And we will be back in a couple of weeks.
Thank you so much for listening to Reconceive. Don't forget to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes so that you don't miss an episode. Follow us at Reconceive Podcast on Facebook or Instagram, and find us on our website at beyondstudio417.com/reconceive. And if anything you've heard today has made you wonder if it's time to reach out for help, please don't ignore that. Message us for assistance in finding a qualified therapist in your area. We would enjoy helping you in that way. From all of us here at Reconceive, see you next time.